Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Alex Ritson, and in the early hours of Thursday, the 6th of July, these are our main stories. The UN's nuclear watchdog calls for greater access to the Russian-occupied Zaporizhzhia power plant after Ukraine said explosives had been planted there. Angry crowds have confronted Palestinian Authority officials in Jenin, accusing them of weakness in the face of Israel's offensive there. And
we were bought by a Tunisian man, but he would also loan me out to work as a cleaner at two other IS bases. At all these places, I would go to work, I would clean, and I would be raped.
We have a special report on the plight of tens of thousands of missing Yazidis on the border with Iraq and Syria. Also in this podcast, the World Health Organization prepares 18 million doses of the world's first malaria vaccine for countries in Africa. And two previously unknown Rembrandts are up for auction at Christie's in London. We start in Ukraine, where there is increasing unease surrounding Zaporizhzhia nuclear power plant in the Russian-occupied east of the country. It's Europe's biggest nuclear plant, and in recent days, Ukrainian officials have been warning that they suspect the Russians may be planning to sabotage it. They're also warning that if an incident happened, Moscow may try to blame it on Kyiv. The Ukrainian president, Volodymyr Zelensky, said he believed Russia was planning dangerous provocations at the Zaporizhzhia plant.
Now we have information from our intelligence that the Russian military has placed objects similar to explosives on the roof of several power units of the Zaporizhzhia nuclear power plant. It's probable they need it to simulate an attack on the plant, or they could have some other kind of scenario. But in any case, the world sees and cannot avoid seeing that the only source of danger to the Zaporizhzhia nuclear power plant is Russia and no one else.
The UN's nuclear watchdog, the IAEA, says its experts have not yet seen any indication of mines or explosives at the plant, but it said they need more access to be sure. Bethany Bell reports from Vienna, where the IAEA is based.
In a statement, the IAEA said its experts based at Zaporizhzhia have carried out partial inspections of the site and have so far not seen signs of mines or explosives. But it said they had requested additional access, particularly to the rooftops of two of the reactor units, to confirm the absence of mines. The head of the IAEA, Rafael Grossi, said the independent and objective reporting of its experts was crucial at this time of military tension. He has repeatedly warned of the dangers posed to the nuclear plant by the ongoing conflict.
Bethany Bell. Danielle Palumbo from BBC Verify has been speaking to Rebecca Kesby about what their analysis of the plant has unearthed.
Today, we have been able to compare and analyze a high-resolution satellite image of the power plant. We have been able to see all the different complex, and we can see that there are some trucks and some military vehicle in the nuclear plant premises. However, when analyzing and studying closely the roof, especially of reactor number 3 and 4, that are actually are said by the Ukrainian army, that are the ones where these claimed explosive devices are installed, we actually can't see any change. We can't see any additional element on it.
Okay, so, you can't see. There's been no change that you can tell in the past few days.
Yes, there has been no change essentially in the structure of the roof.
I suppose the thing with propaganda on each side is that the information is out there, it gets spun in different ways, and actually the fear that this is causing for many people on both sides of that conflict is probably very real, because if anything did happen to this plant, it would be very serious, wouldn't it?
Yes, absolutely, because anyway is one of the biggest nuclear plants in Europe. And despite having its activity level significantly drop, the fact that, of course, there is uranium and there is a radioactive material there is extremely important. But also all the area is where essentially most of the grain production takes place. And Zaporizhzhia itself is a very big city. In fact, today we are starting to see a lot of people queuing in grocery shops and supermarkets across the cities. Definitely the situation doesn't make anybody feel comfortable.
Daniel Palumbo speaking to Rebecca Casby. It's been a day of rage on the streets of Jenin following Israel's military operation in the occupied West Bank. Palestinian men came out in their thousands for the funerals of the 12 people who were killed. Crowds confronted officials from the Palestinian Authority, which has been accused of being too weak to stop Israel. The officials were told to get out. Israel was targeting militants in Jenin who remained defiant despite the widespread destruction in the city. A huge clear-up operation is underway. Fakhri Torakman is the head of the reconstruction committee at the camp.
What happened here was an organized criminal act. Israel is a terrorist state that used all its power and all the tools it has to destroy and terrorize a refugee camp in Jenin. It destroyed the infrastructure in a way that is unacceptable and unprecedented.
Israel said the operation had achieved its aims by closing what it called the Jenin terrorism factory. One of its soldiers was killed. Our correspondent Anna Foster spent the day in the camp and told me what she saw.
Picture, if you will, you know, roads that are strewn with broken glass, bullet casings, in some cases cars that have been flipped over by those armoured Israeli bulldozers that came in at the start of the operation looking for improvised explosive devices, roadside bombs that the Israelis, they said they'd found 11 of them actually on civilian roads inside the refugee camp. And interestingly, just in the last hour or so, as I left the camp to talk to you, they've been putting in roadblocks at the camp entrances, rudimentary roadblocks with big stones, with gas bottles and pieces of metal, not the sort of thing that's normally there. And I think reflects on two fronts, the concern that Israeli troops may return, which I don't think will happen, but it shows you that nervousness that people have, and also concern about their own Palestinian security forces. There were some clashes last night with people who live in the camp and with Palestinian Authority security forces, people blaming them for, I think, not stepping in, the suggestion is, not supporting them and allowing this Israeli mission to go ahead. So I think it's noticeable when you see things like that happening in the camp. It gives you an insight, really, into how people are feeling in the aftermath of this very sizable Israeli military operation there.
What will happen to the 3,000 people who had to flee their homes? Do they have homes to go back to?
Some of them are back already, actually. I was speaking to one man this morning who returned. He fled with his elderly mother, with his four children, and he was glad to be back, but he talked about his concerns for the future. And he also talked about his children, and in particular, he talked about his fears for their mental health, not just his children, but other children who already, if you think about it, are living in a refugee camp, which is an enormously difficult environment for any child to live in. And he just talked about what they had witnessed and the fears that his children had and his difficulties as a father in trying to keep them safe in an environment like this one.
Anna Foster. Let's take a closer look at the question of relations between young people in the occupied West Bank and the Palestinian Authority, set up during the 1990s as part of the Oslo peace process that in turn was meant to lead to the creation of a Palestinian state. James Menendez has been talking to Jalal Abu Hatta, a writer from Jerusalem who also works with a lot of young Palestinians as a trainer with Right to Movement, which organises runs and other outdoor activities in several cities, including Haifa, Jaffa, Jerusalem, Bethlehem and Ramallah.
The lack of governance, lack of democracy, I don't believe any of the young people, except those who are politically affiliated and activists with political parties such as the ruling Fatah Party or Hamas, they don't feel the association that is necessary for political representation to be proper. Even today in Jenin, there was videos being shared of people kicking out representatives of the PA of Fatah during the funerals of the martyrs of Jenin. So young people especially don't associate and don't support the political representatives who claim to speak in their name. That the political system is dysfunctional, that there's not been an election for over 15, 20 years. Many people, like 18 to 25, haven't ever voted in their lives, myself included. And this leads to not just, you know, disassociation, but it leads to animosity towards those who claim to represent them, but are not really elected.
Is there any faith among young people in the idea of a two-state solution with a Palestinian state alongside Israel?
I think the two-state solution is probably an obsolete idea. People speak here of liberation, of justice, of a struggle for rights. They speak of dignity in daily life. They speak of access and ways to build a life with their families and better educational system and better healthcare. So young people are not interested in engaging in the framework of the two-state solution because it's irrelevant to them. And the prospect of a two-state solution is not something that many people believe in Palestine anyways.
Jalal Abukata speaking to James Menendez. The social media giant Meta, which owns Facebook and Instagram, has launched its new app, Threads. It went live at 2300 hours GMT on Wednesday. It was originally scheduled to launch on Thursday. The app will be linked to Instagram and is widely seen as a major rival to Twitter. Meta describes Threads as a text-based conversation app. Screen grabs of it show a dashboard that looks similar to Twitter. Rights organisations say millions of people from socially underprivileged groups in India are increasingly subject to discrimination and violence despite legal protection. On Wednesday, police in the central Indian state of Madhya Pradesh arrested a man for urinating on a labourer from a tribal community in public. And in a separate case, a court has given 10-year jail terms to 10 men for beating a Muslim man to death in the eastern state of Jharkhand 4 years ago. Our South Asia editor Anbarasan Etarajan told me more about the two incidents.
A video on Wednesday emerged on social media. It was shocking to watch it because it showed a man who was smoking a cigarette at the same time urinating on the face of a tribal youth. He was sitting on the ground. This triggered outrage across the country, and many political parties strongly condemned. And the government of Madhya Pradesh today said they had arrested this man, Parvesh Shukla. He belongs to the upper caste in the Indian caste system. Many people are calling for very stringent punishment against Mr. Shukla for this act. And it has also triggered a widespread debate on how the tribals and indigenous communities are being treated, because there are laws in India which strongly protects, which strongly suggests punishment for any kind of crimes against indigenous communities or socially underprivileged groups. There are 200 million people who belong to the scheduled caste and scheduled tribes. But still, these kind of things happening. Many of these tribes, they work in farms as laborers in the city. They work as domestic help. They often complain that because of their ethnicity, they are being ill-treated and sometimes they get beaten.
And this isn't a standalone case. I also mentioned the Muslim man Tabriz Ansari, who was beaten to death in the eastern state of Jharkhand 4 years ago. And there have been several similar incidents reported in India in recent years.
There are about close to 200 million Muslims in India, and human rights groups have documented dozens of cases of attacks against Muslims, particularly men. But in this particular case, this Muslim man was accused of trying to steal a motorcycle in the village, and then the villagers, they beat him up, and then police later on took him into custody. In fact, they arrested him despite him having severe injuries. But after a couple of days, his health condition deteriorated, and then he was admitted to hospital where he, doctors said, he died of his injuries. And his family, they were accusing the police of not taking him to hospital immediately after he was beaten severely by this mob. This is not an isolated case, as I was mentioning earlier. There have been a number of incidents where the Muslim youths were being targeted and they were being asked to shout Hindu religious slogans. They were beaten. Sometimes the Muslim traders are asked not to sell their items in the Hindu-dominated areas. So this kind of religious polarization is going on. But the government says these are all isolated incidents. There is no organized attack on religious communities. They are living much safer than in many other countries.
Anbarasan Etarajan. In 2014, the world watched with horror as the Islamic State group took over the Sinjar district on the border between Iraq and Syria after Peshmerga fighters withdrew. Sinjar was home to the Yazidi population, seen as infidels by IS. What followed was described by a UN commission as a genocide. But nearly 9 years later, some 300,000 Yazidis have still not returned, and 120,000 Yazidis are still living in tents, exiled in their own country. Rachel Wright went to northern Iraq to find out what was happening to them.
So we've we've just come into a whole series of prefabricated huts with a couple of hundred children, very, very excited.
So we've got 10 little girls, probably aged around 6.
A whole generation of Yazidi children have grown up in these tents in a small town near the Kurdish city of Duhok in northern Iraq. But why? Well, in 2014, the Islamic State group swept into the Sinjar district on the Iraqi-Syrian border after the Kurdish forces left the area unprotected. Around 5,000 Yazidis were murdered and almost 7,000 women and children captured and used as sex slaves. Bahar was one of them. She'd been separated from her husband and eldest son, who she never saw again.
We were bought by a Tunisian man. We stayed at his home, but he would also loan me out to work as a cleaner at two other IS bases. At all these places, I would go to work, I would clean, and I would be raped.
Bahar and her three children were bought and sold 5 times in total. But what she didn't know was that fellow Yazidis were trying to find her. Businessman Barzad Farhan was one of them. His organisation, Kinyat, was using the chat group Telegram to try and find the missing women.
Our idea was that smugglers would be able to reach these people. They would smuggle alcohol and cigarettes in and out of IS territory. They did it all for cash. That was their only motive. Many people were paid thousands of dollars to buy back these girls.
Which is what happened to Bahar.
Someone came on a motorbike. He came up to us and said the code word Saeed. Then he told all of us to get on his motorbike, me and all three children. The guy on the motorcycle said, "Listen, we're in IS territory. There are checkpoints. If they ask you anything, don't say a word so they don't recognise your Yazidi accent." And he took us to his home. And they said, "You're in safe hands now."
It cost around $20,000 to buy Bahar's freedom. She and her three children have been living in a tent near the Kurdish city of Duhok ever since, nearly 8 years. Around 2,700 women and children are still missing. The 6,000-year-old Lalish Temple is the spiritual home of the Yazidis, one of the oldest religions in the world. At the temple, I meet Haider Elias, the head of the Yazidi organization Yazda.
The Yazidis have been under attack since many centuries. And a lot of Muslim population, younger or older, believe they should be converted or die. That's why we believe that ISIS is not the extent of it or not the end of it. And that's really unfortunately scary for the Yazidi people.
Haider says most of the 300,000 Yazidis who were forced to leave Sinjar and are now living in exile in their own country would like to return. But Sinjar is still a war zone. And the Kurdish regional government is at loggerheads with the Iraqi government in Baghdad over what to do with the displaced Yazidis.
Are you hopeful at all?
If we decide to save the Yazidi human, we will advocate for migration. If we decide to save the Yazidi culture and religion, we will advocate for them to be protected here in Iraq.
And you can hear more from Rachel Wright and the Yazidis' fate in Iraq on this week's assignment on the BBC World Service. Still to come on the Global News podcast.
Any action that is taken is fundamentally justified and with a very solid basis. Then confidence will come, I'm sure, with time.
The head of the UN nuclear watchdog tries to allay concerns about plans to discharge treated water from the wrecked Fukushima power plant in Japan into the Pacific Ocean. Malaria remains one of Africa's deadliest diseases. Now, the World Health Organization and its partners say that about 18 million doses of the world's first vaccine against it will be delivered to 12 African nations by 2025. Dorcas Wangira reports from Nairobi.
Nearly every minute in the continent, a child under the age of 5 dies of malaria. The demand for the first 18 million allocated doses of the RTSS vaccine is very high, far exceeding the supply. WHO, Gavi and other partners said they considered which countries had the greatest need, the maximum health impact and equity. Malawi, Ghana and Kenya, which had already administered the vaccines in a pilot phase to at least least 1.7 million children have been allocated 6.9 million doses. For the first time, 8 countries, Benin, Burkina Faso, Burundi, Cameroon, the Democratic Republic of Congo, Liberia, Sierra Leone and Uganda, will roll out the vaccine in their routine programs. Niger will have a partial allocation. However, Mozambique and Sudan will not receive any doses owing to their high vaccine dropout rates. RTSS is the first malaria vaccine recommended for use to prevent malaria in children in areas of moderate to high malaria transmission. It is administered in 4 doses from 5 months to 2 years of age. WHO says it could save one life for every 200 children vaccinated.
Dorcas Wangira. Vulnerable nations have expressed concern following the release of an internal government document suggesting that Britain is likely to break a key financial pledge to help developing countries deal with climate change. The paper says the government has consistently underspent on its promise to give almost $15 billion to developing nations, and it will now be a huge challenge to meet the target. With more details, here's our climate editor, Justin Rowlett.
The £11.6 billion promise was made with some fanfare by then Prime Minister Boris Johnson in 2019. But this leaked Foreign Office briefing paper for ministers warns the government is now so behind it would need to spend 83% of the total overseas aid budget on climate action in vulnerable nations to catch up. The document warns this would require a reorientation of the budget on a scale which has not previously been achieved. That is being interpreted to mean civil servants believe the government is very unlikely to meet its spending pledge for developing countries. Claire Shakya is from the International Institute for Environment and Development.
The poorest countries are going to be incredibly disappointed by this. They need that money and they need it now to help them to adapt to the impacts of climate change. But it also gives the opportunity for other rich countries to say we're not going to meet what we promised either.
The government today denied it had any plans to drop the spending pledge and said it remained committed to spending £11.6 billion on international climate finance. It said it had spent more than £1.4 billion on climate action in developing nations in the last financial year and promised the latest figures would be published in due course.
Our environment editor, Justin Rowlett. Politicians are keen to reassure people that releasing more than 1 million tonnes of water from Japan's Fukushima nuclear power plant into the Pacific Ocean is safe. To that end, and although he's already spoken about this, the head of the UN nuclear watchdog, Rafael Grossi, went to the plant. Here's a little of what he had to say there.
We must explain, we must be clear, we must listen to everybody and make sure that any action that is taken is fundamentally and sufficiently justified and with a very solid basis. Then confidence will come, I'm sure, with time.
Our Asia Pacific regional editor, Will Leonardo, first of all reminded me about the worries.
It's more than 1 million tonnes of contaminated water used to cool the reactors at the Fukushima nuclear power plant that was damaged in the 2011 earthquake and tsunami. All this water is sitting in massive storage tanks on land, but space is running out. And Japan's plan is to use advanced technology to clean this water of most radioactive material, but one not-so-harmful isotope called tritium can't be removed. So then the water will go through a dilution process and then it will be released into the sea. And at that point, Tokyo says it will be less radioactive than drinking water. But it's natural that the idea of dumping this water has caused huge resistance by locals, including fishermen and Japan's neighbours in South Korea and China.
So how is the head of the UN nuclear watchdog, Rafael Grossi, how is he reassuring people?
One of his main ways of doing this, before heading to the plant, he met local residents and officials in Fukushima and he promised that the IAEA would oversee the discharge until the very end. And now that could be up to 4 decades, and the UN agency is setting up an office in Fukushima to do this. At the plant himself, he inspected the cleaning technology and stressed that the key to calming fears was listening and explaining, and he said he was sure that confidence would grow as years wore on. He's also off to South Korea next, where the government has been leading its own reassurance campaign for a very wary public.
I spoke to a scientist this time yesterday who said he'd be ready to swim in the water. Did we get any kind of similar reaction from Mr. Grossi?
Well, not quite. I mean, he didn't quite drink the water as some South Korean opposition officials have been calling on Japanese officials to be doing. But, you know, it's all about this charm offensive that he's been leading, really. You know, kind of claims from South Korean officials that Japanese officials should be drinking the water just shows the level of concern and anger that this whole issue has caused over the past 2 years since Japan has announced that it was going ahead with this plan.
But this is about perceptions, isn't it? And is him turning up really going to change anyone's opinion?
Well, I suppose the main thing is that it shows that it's not a unilateral move by Tokyo. You know, this is the world's nuclear watchdog. It's respected on a variety of topics around the world. And also, locally speaking, it calms fears among those near the plant who've been untrustworthy of local officials and the TEPCO power company that operates the Fukushima nuclear plant. But the main thing to mention is it's pretty much a done deal now. You know, Japan and TEPCO saw no other options. It can't keep accumulating the water on land, storage space is running out, and it's already planning, according to local reports, to discharge the water by the end of the summer, as early as August. And I suppose the hope is that the detractors of this idea kind of settle into it.
Will Leonardo. Geneva will welcome dozens of humanoid robots on Thursday at the start of a UN summit on artificial intelligence. The summit in Switzerland, hosted by the United Nations International Telecommunications Union, will focus on how AI can be used to make life easier and better, but amid concerns that the new technology is racing ahead. The summit will also discuss rules for its use. Imogen Folks has more details.
AI for Good is the summit's title. The ITU is determined to show that artificial intelligence can benefit humanity. There will be plenty of examples on display, from Nadine the robot, who specialises in social care, to mapping tools for aid agencies assessing hunger, to rapid, thanks to AI, diagnosis of common diseases. Industry giants like Amazon, Google and Microsoft will attend. So too will governments and scientists. The ITU, conscious of the worries about such rapidly developing technology, says the summit should also discuss governance of AI and establish guardrails to prevent it exacerbating inequality or promoting bias around race, gender or religion.
Imogen Folks in Geneva. Fans of the Welsh singing legend Tom Jones used to famously throw their knickers at him or their room keys. Music fans in audiences today have taken that trend to a different level, throwing all sorts of things on stage. Adele took her Las Vegas audience to task recently, jokingly suggesting that she'd kill anyone who tried to throw something at her. This is no laughing matter, though. Last month, pop star Bebe Rexha was injured and taken to hospital for stitches after being hit by a phone while performing. And here's Pink just over a week ago, not surprisingly uncomfortable when a fan threw a bag of her mother's ashes on stage.
This is your mom? I don't know how we feel about this.
If you could hear that, that was, "Is this your mum?" she asks. "I don't know how to feel about this." Kirsty Sedgman is an audiences researcher at Bristol University here in England and author of Being Unreasonable. Sarah Montague asked her if there was something happening in particular that could explain this trend.
Yes, if you'd asked me before lockdown, then I'd have said things have always been this way. In fact, the ancient Greeks were complaining about people being too active in their participation and said they should be controlled with a stick. But it seems undeniable. I work with a great deal of people throughout the cultural industries, and everybody is saying the same thing. Things have got so much worse after we came back from lockdown.
Worse in what way? What are we talking about?
It's both the number of these kinds of incidences has skyrocketed, but also the ferocity of the response when some people are called out for doing something that is clearly irresponsible and even dangerous. We've seen, again, throughout the cultural industries that that's led to audience altercations between themselves and even riots.
What is it that the audience is wanting?
Well, part of this is an age-old desire to form it's called a parasocial relationship with famous celebrities, which in these mediated ages is very much one-sided. You know, fans very much feel as if they know their favourite celebrity in person, and celebrities have no idea who that person is or that they even exist. So part of this is the desire to break through that barrier and form a connection. but that's not to excuse it.
Okay, even if the connection is your phone hitting them.
Yeah, and sometimes it's about trying to capture a recording, of course, and people are taking it far too far.
Right, so what, they're wanting the performer to pick up the phone and take a picture?
Or perhaps some people have set it recording and try to throw it onto the stage so it'll capture a shot.
Is there one way, some way just briefly to rein in whole society in, on things like this?
Well, we need to understand why it's happening, and people are coming with this tremendous desire to connect with people, but also, as I say in On Being Unreasonable, there is an upsurge in what I call don't tell me what to do-itis, the sense that, well, if the social contract is broken down, then I should be able to do whatever I like because I've paid so much money for this experience. And we have to understand that.
Kirsty Sedgman speaking to Sarah Montague. Two exceptionally rare portraits by the 17th century Dutch artist Rembrandt are going up for auction in London on Thursday after lying undiscovered in a family's private collection for 200 years. The paintings, which until recently had been completely unknown to art scholars, were discovered by experts from the auction house Christie's during a routine valuation. With more details, here's Tom Bailey.
Described as one of the most exciting discoveries in the old masters field in recent years, the pictures are believed to be the last known pair of Rembrandt portraits to remain in private hands. Completed in 1635 and standing just 20 centimetres tall, they depict an elderly couple who were close to the artist and his family. Experts say the fact that they had been completely unknown to art historians until now was extraordinary for an artist of the Dutch great status. The portraits, which were authenticated after extensive scientific analysis undertaken at Amsterdam's Rijksmuseum, are expected to sell for between $6 and $10 million.
Tom Bailey. And that's all from us for now. But before we go, here's a request from my fellow presenter, Nick Miles.
Hi, just a quick one to thank everybody who's already sent in their thoughts about artificial intelligence, but please do keep them coming. Just a reminder, early next week we are recording a special global news podcast looking at the opportunities and the challenges presented by artificial intelligence. We want you to tell us, what are your hopes and fears about AI now and in the future? Just send us a short email, a sentence or two will do, or better still, a voice note starting with your name and where you're from to the normal address. globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. We will have a panel of experts on hand to answer many of your questions at King's College London next week. Thanks a lot.
This edition was mixed by Caroline Driscoll, and the producer was Emma Joseph. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Alex Ritson. Until next time, goodbye.
Summer of Dash Pass is here. Get more to your door for less. Groceries, self-care, and restaurants. Subscribe to save up to 50% off your order. Plus, no delivery fees with Dash Pass from DoorDash. Start your 30-day free trial now. Terms apply.